708 днів у
708 днів у російському полоні.
Українская летчица Надежда Савченко в Киеве.
В аэропорту по прилету Савченко встречают десятки.
Сегодня же Владимир Путин помиловал Надежду Савченко, приговоренную в России.
Надежда Савченко заявила, что готова снова взять в руки оружие и положить свою жизнь
за Украину. What happens now? After 708 days in Russian captivity, Ukrainian military pilot Nadia Savchenko returned home to a hero's welcome this week. And as a result, Ukraine may just have gained something it has long lacked and badly needs, a political figure with clear and unambiguous moral authority, someone uncorrupted, unsullied by the past, and uncompromised by the current elite, someone who took herself to the brink of death for the sake of Ukraine and who unforgettably flipped the bird at Vladimir Putin's kangaroo court. For nearly 2 years, Nadia Savchenko has been a powerful symbol of resistance and resolve for Ukrainians. And now that she's free, what role will she play? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from London is Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Hey there.
And with me here in the studio is Natalia Chudikova, managing editor of RFRL's Ukrainian service and host of the program European Connect. Welcome back, Natalia. It's been too long. It's always a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you, Brian. Hello.
So, well, I got a lot of grief for writing on my blog this week that Savchenko could, and I stress could, turn out to be Ukraine's Václav Havel, or it's Lech Walesa, or maybe it's Nelson Mandela. But you know what? Despite the grief, I stick by that. And for all you literalists out there on the Twitter, of course, I know Savchenko isn't Havel, Walesa, or Mandela. She's Savchenko. But what I have in mind is that figures like this, who've suffered and persevered for a higher cause, have the potential to carry with them a large degree of moral authority should they choose to seize it. And Savchenko is arriving on the political scene at a time when Ukrainians are clearly disillusioned with their leaders. She'll pose a moral challenge to the current political elite, from President Petro Poroshenko on down, to live up to the promise of the Euromaidan revolution. And with a seat in the Rada, she certainly has a platform. Nadia, your thoughts on this?
Well, she's definitely a strong moral authority. She is a person badly needed in the Ukrainian politics, a person who is very straightforward, and a person who can tell the truth no matter what or how important the person she's talking to. We could see yesterday when she was, or the day before, when she accepted her golden medal of the Hero of Ukraine, she even forgot to thank President Poroshenko for that. And she said that it was purely the because of the activities of her sister and her family and the Ukrainian community as a whole that she was released from the Russian prison, and that the politicians played a minor or a smaller role compared to that.
Politicians only act when the people force them to.
Exactly. And that's something that really resonates very well in the Ukrainian society at the moment, because it is very disappointed about the politicians, about the lack of reforms, about the lack of transparency, about the continued corruption, and all of these things. But of course, she's although she likes to be called politician, and the people around her call her politician, but she's a very inexperienced politician, if we can call her that. And she says she's prepared to learn. She's prepared to do the work of a politician. One thing that is still unclear in what capacity she's going to do that. She stated quite clearly that she wants to go and work for the parliament and work in the parliament in the capacity that she would be most useful in. And she said she knew only two institutions from inside, and it's the army and the prison. So she said that only there she feels competent enough to do something useful.
She's been assigned to the Defense Committee, as I understand.
Yes, there were reports of that. And, well, she said that she really knows the army from the inside and she knows the problems, so she might be doing that.
What do we know about her politics? I mean, because there's very little that's known about this. And I've seen her described as a Ukrainian nationalist, but I don't know what that means in this context, because I've not really heard anything out of her to indicate what her politics are like.
Well, it's probably someone from Russia who described her that, because she likes to say glory to Ukraine and things like that.
It was actually in a Western press report.
Already, which is already enough for being to be called a nationalist in Russia. She is actually more than inexperienced. She was completely uninterested in the Ukrainian politics before. She doesn't even know the main names in the Ukrainian politics. She knows the people who were in who were lobbying for her release, the politicians, and of course the Batyivshchina, the Fatherland Party. And she today during the press conference, you could see that she was standing in front of the signs of the party of Mrs. Tymoshenko. But Poroshenko is Tymoshenko. They're going to be somehow pull her to their side, but it's quite difficult to say if she's going to take any side at all, because she's quite smart enough and she realizes that the disappointment in the Ukrainian society is against all the political class, and they doesn't really matter what your right. last name is.
Yeah, no, this relationship with Yulia Tymoshenko is going to be absolutely fascinating to watch.
You could already see the first signs
the airport,
of it in
the airport. Airport.
Yeah, exactly. When Tymoshenko was trying to sort of get closer to her, and she was sort of almost pushing her back.
Yeah, and which got a lot of attention in the media and social media. Mark, what are your thoughts on this?
Yes, it's very difficult. I mean, I must admit, I'm... inevitably slightly always concerned about when you actually have the whole notion of the sort of the hero on the white horse who comes in as an outsider from the political class. Because, yes, absolutely, we know so little about her. I mean, at the moment, in some ways, Savchenko is a political Rorschach inkblot test that we can just simply all invest with whatever meaning we want.
Then it speaks very well of me that I have named Havel, Mandela, and Valença as the as what I see on the inkblot. Go ahead.
Yes. I hesitate to use the expression wishful thinking. But I mean, I think, again, let's go back to this issue of sort of her politics. Exactly. We know nothing at all about it. And I agree entirely with Natalia that she seems to have not been particularly interested. I mean, it's worth mentioning that, I mean, before she was captured, she was working as a volunteer with one of the volunteer militia battalions, specifically IDAR, which actually Amnesty International have cited for human rights violations. Now, I'm not for a minute saying that she's actually some kind of brutal Ukrainian nationalist who, you know, is quite happy to see human rights violations or whatever, but at the very least, then that says either that she was more so interested in being part of the fighting that in a way she didn't really care the details of who she was working with, as long as they were, as it were, on the right side, or that she was at least willing to sort of go along with that. So the best, I mean, one could say, is a certain political tone deafness. And certainly comes around. I mean, she, you know, her rhetoric so far has been very tough, and absolutely she's in touch with this zeitgeist that is rather sick of the political class. Very definitely she's... I mean, there's a phrase she came up with, the peace is achievable only after war. There is a crossroads after which there's no turning back. And she clearly feels that, you know, that is a situation. In my view, in other circumstances, if we looked at a figure who was populist, very much sort of speaking out against the political class, military background, rather maximalist in the views, we actually would be worried. And this is the point. Look, I don't want to suggest that actually, oh, no, Savchenko is going to be some kind of neo-fascist demagogue or whatever. But the whole point is we have absolutely no idea. And for me, I was thinking of parallels. And the one that came up for me was Alexander Rutskoy. Russian helicopter pilot, You know, highly decorated, highly effective, shot down several times, had been prisoner of war, came back, strong moral authority, in this is in the late 80s. Boris Yeltsin picked him precisely because he thought he could use Rutskoy's charisma and authority as his running mate in the 1991 elections. He became vice president, and first of all, he actually turned out to be distinctly nationalist. I mean, in fact, he was actually threatening Ukraine over Crimea at one point. And then basically by 1993, he turned against Yeltsin, and he became essentially the figurehead of the Supreme Soviet and the other sort of retread, you know, old Communist Party hacks against whom Yeltsin turned his tanks gunfire in 1993. Now, again, I'm not saying for a moment that Savchenko is going to be Rutskoy, just because they're both helicopter pilots. But the thing I would want to bring out is precisely this risk that when you have politicians who think that they can use these outsiders in order to bolster their own credentials, which is clearly what both Poroshenko and Timoshenko are trying to do. Well, actually, you're bringing in people who do not come from the same rule set as you. You're bringing in people who you know of just simply as soldiers, and now they're going to have to start looking at the civilian world, and they will often look at the civilian world as soldiers do, in much more, I won't say simplistic, but much more straightforward terms. This can actually be terribly dangerous for those people who try to use these people.
I'm dying to hear Natalia's answer to that.
It's really interesting because you're saying that they're trying to make deals with those people, and Rutskoy was quite capable of doing these kind of deals, and she seems to be a person who is absolutely incapable of making deals. And there were so many times while she was in prison that they were trying to do some sorts of deals. And even before that, we know her as a person, as one of the first women pilots, that she could spend 3 nights in front of the ministers of defense door in order to get to him, and in order to get her a possibility to study as a military pilot. She was twice dismissed from the school, from the military school, for misbehavior, and then she was able to get back. So she's clearly a person, anti-systemic person. She is a person who is absolutely incapable of seeing that being able to comply just because it's somehow would be beneficial for her. Yeah. She is prepared to risk everything, to risk her life, to risk her health, and it's not the first time that she could that she was on a hunger strike in prison. She said that she went through a military training where she had she could not sleep for 2 days, or she could not eat for a couple of days, for several days, or something like that.
The backstory of how she became the first female military pilot in Ukraine is actually interesting in and of itself, and even independent of
exactly.
the history.
And it tells you a lot about this person. It's really an anti-systemic person.
And very stubborn.
Exactly.
Clearly very stubborn.
There's a limit to how anti-systemic you can be if you're a soldier. Yes, of course, she's demonstrated phenomenal and indomitable will. But, I mean, just as there's a huge difference between making deals with the Russians to get out of prison and being involved in a political process in your own country with, you know, and with the prospect of being able to actually have some kind of traction, you hope, on the outcome. But likewise, look, however, you know, she has said, you know, without in any way to taking away from her, the very fact that she can operate within a disciplined military environment, you know, says something about her capacity to, as it were, be anti-systemic but also systemic. And I think this is one of the interesting things.
I think that would be a plus in politics, no?
Well, except soldiers have a tendency to not do well in politics. Actually, sort of there is commonly this assumption that you can bring the war hero across, who actually has all the glory. That actually often doesn't really work in politics, which we like to sort of decry all the muddy compromises of politics. And certainly, actually, Kiev is waist deep in mud with very little compromise at the moment. And you know, there is absolutely the need for some kind of greater moral clarity, something to actually try and finally kickstart a revolution that really is now 2 years without actually making much substantive progress. So there is certainly a need. The issue is whether or not actually it takes an outsider to do it. And what the risks are of an outsider? Because after all, she's already gone on record saying, "Well, yes, maybe I could be president."
You anticipated me. I want to play that clip in a minute, but go ahead.
Well, do so. I think she's certainly not at this stage, demonstrating any shyness about political ambition.
And Mark, you prompted me perfectly there in a press conference actually today. Savchenko was asked if she would be interested in the Ukrainian presidency, and here's what she had to say.
Let us put it this way. Ukrainians, if you need me to be the president, okay, I will be the president. Honestly, I cannot say that I want to be the president. I love to fly. But if necessary, I will do everything. I will take this way and work hard.
I don't know about you, but I was impressed by that answer because it was in response. In fairness to her, she didn't stand up there and make this announcement. It was a question.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And she said, well, I mean, if you want me to be president, I can be president. Honestly, I'd rather be a pilot, but I'll do anything for Ukraine. I mean, actually, I thought she got the tone exactly right there. And it showed a bit of political savvy that I wasn't sure whether she had or not. What was your reaction?
I think she's a very natural person, and it's her natural behavior. And she behaves exactly the same, whether it is in prison, whether it is in the Russian court, whether it is among her friends or at a press conference. And she felt absolutely free, and she said what her mind was at the moment. And she said, well, if you want me to be a pilot, I'll be a pilot. If I can do more for the country, I'll do more for the country. And I'm prepared to do anything for the country, and even to be president, even though she said that, of course, she's very inexperienced. But then she also said a very important thing about the society, if the society is ready enough for serious change and not to vote for populists who promise immediate benefits like barley corn or the buckwheat.
She used the Ukrainian word for buckwheat, which is
exactly
a slang for this voting for populists.
Exactly.
Mark, your thoughts?
Yeah, look, I really don't want to end up becoming the Savchenko sort of critic here. but I think let's be perfectly honest. There is something of a discrepancy here. I mean, first of all, look, no politician ever says, I am salivating for the opportunity to sit behind the big desk. The standard answer is always, well, of course, I have no ambitions in that direction, but nonetheless, if the party, the people, or whatever really want me to, I would sort of rise to the occasion. Look, she says that she'd rather be a pilot. I don't think there's any doubt that if she turned around and said, no, actually politics is not for me, I'm a frontline officer and that's where I want to be, no one's going to say, well, you can't. She's willing to be within the political context, precisely. And again, because I'm sure she and people around her feel that she can actually make the most good there, rather than being just one person in the cockpit of a chopper, actually being able to ensure, for example, that there are enough helicopters at the front line and they actually have fuel and pilots to operate. You know, there is
which she'll have the ability to do in the Defence Committee.
Well, precisely. Let's strip away some of the some of the rhetoric. I mean, she has chosen for the moment to take a political path. And in some ways, it actually might speak well for her that she's already, that she is able to, in some ways, adopt the standard sort of rhetoric of the politician. No populist ever says anything other than I'm against populism, for a start. But on the other hand, there is inevitably going to be a point at which Savchenko the politician and Savchenko the moral icon actually will come into conflict. And for me, that's the interesting thing, because this is inevitably the honeymoon period at the moment. And especially as Timoshenko and Poroshenko both want to be associated with her and hope that some of the luster will come over her. I mean, Poroshenko's desperate attempt to make it clear this was a kind of presidential initiative, let alone Timoshenko's again. Again, that's fine for a bit. Given that she doesn't look at all willing to be co-opted as the mascot of any other particular leader, it's going to be interesting to see how they cope with that and how she responds, because that, I think, will be the true benchmark.
I'm waiting to see how she responds the first time a fistfight breaks out in the
Next
Rada.
Next Tuesday, we'll see it in the Parliament.
Yeah, I'm waiting to see what happens the first time a fistfight breaks out in the Rada, what she does. But Mark hits on an important point here, and this is something I wanted to touch on, is when Savchenko, the symbol, bumps into the dirty, gritty reality that is Ukrainian politics. And how long can she stay above the fray here? Is she inevitably just going to become just another politician?
Well, I think we're quite safe from that, because because what is everyone expects her, and so far she's been very upfront about that everyone expects her to pull all this dirty world of the Ukrainian politics into light. And well, I think this is something, if she can't do it, then who can do it? Because if a person who's gone through so much and who has proven her commitment to the country and her absolute fearlessness in the light of all kind of dangers, if she cannot do it, then who else? And it's a really difficult moment for the Ukrainian public, for the people who looked at her as a symbol, not to be disappointed with the real person when she comes to the Parliament, when she starts to...
Because she's going to make mistakes.
Of course.
She's going to get criticized.
Of course.
She's going to do things people disagree with. It's going to... There might be scandal. You know, we don't... This politics is
exactly
dirty.
Exactly. But the thing is that what we were missing in the politics in Ukraine for so many years is that someone who, with the right set of principles, with the right set of values, and with the guts to express them.
Mm-hmm. And this is you basically just said the heart of my argument of when I said Ukraine's hovel, Ukraine's Valenza, Ukraine's Mandela. I didn't mean she's exactly the same as these people. I meant she's going to can play that role, because that role has been sorely absent in
Absolutely.
Ukrainian politics. We've never seen a figure like this in 25 years of independence.
Exactly. On the national level. You could argue that Mustafa Jamilev, the leader of the Crimean Tatars, is that kind of person. But he has always been seen as the leader of Crimean Tatars,
right,
not on the great scale of the Ukrainian politics. And which, well, in some sense, I think it was a mistake. But now we have a different person on that level of moral authority, yes.
Yeah, no, and you can look at, I mean, Leonard Meri in Estonia, for example, played this role as Estonia's first post-Soviet president. He was a very blunt-talking person who's not afraid to say anything to anybody. I mean, there's this niche exists in societies that are going through transition. Ukraine's never had somebody filling that niche. It had a terrific civil society that was light years ahead of its leaders. But it's always been hemmed in by the fact that its leaders were post-Soviet and were doing things in the typical post-Soviet way. Mark, you want to jump in?
Yeah. I think that one of the interesting things is, as it were, what the Savchenko phenomenon says about Ukrainian politics. And this extraordinary disillusion with precisely a political class who have clearly, patently are failing to live up to the aspirations and expectations of the Maidan. And that's always been a real worry, because what happens when people's expectations fail? Do they just simply settle down to despondency and think, well, nothing can possibly change for another political generation, and cope with it and live with it? And in some ways, I mean, that for quite some time is what Yanukovych kind of relied upon, until it no longer was enough. Or do they start looking for alternative and potentially radical solutions? The people who are exactly sort of outside the system and basically saying that we need to do things sort of dramatic and disastrous. And this is when the risk of using the F word, this is where there would have been a risk for some kind of fascist in some form or another. Potential backlash. Not that I think Ukraine would ever fall to fascism, but nonetheless, the rise of that kind of movement again. Now, the interesting thing with Savchenko is that precisely because at the moment, at least, she seems willing to operate within the system. She wants to be not just a voice on the outside crying woes onto the Rada, but actually work within the Rada. She wants to be on the Defense Committee rather than just simply writing columns in newspapers criticizing what the Defense Committee does. That's all an encouraging sign. And so, again, you know, there is a chance that she can indeed grow into a figure who is able to bridge these two worlds. The worlds of the people who actually want to do things for the good of Ukraine, and the world of the people who actually can operate the machinery in order to actually get something done. However, when it comes down to it, you know, if you mention people like Havel and so forth, they did so in relatively uncontested environments. Yeah. There were huge challenges and so forth, but in a way, precisely, there was just a sort of, there was something of a consensus. And just what was needed was the person who could be that single crystal around which the rest of society can crystallize. Ukraine is a much, much more, frankly, vicious and multi-vector, multipolar political world, I think it's fair to say. What she won't be able to do is really make, I think, a significant positive impact in the long term without some kind of institutional basis. A party or a movement.
Well, she's a member. She's a member of Tymoshenko's party.
Yeah.
No, she isn't. Exactly. She reiterated today that she didn't want to leave that party. She was asked about that. How could you be in this party that does so much business with oligarchs? Mm-hmm. And she said she's going to stay in this party. I don't know what her reasoning is. Maybe Natalia, you can shed some light on that.
It's really difficult because how else would she get into the parliament if she was not the member of the party, and she wants to get into the parliament now, not to wait for the next elections and not to wait until the next party is being created. So I think she doesn't really think in terms of the party, in terms of party politics, in terms of party program and things like that. She needs a party to be in the parliament, to do things that she knows about, and I think that's the main reason. Mm-hmm. And also, she is a loyal person, I think. And in terms of being in the army, being as a soldier, she's a part of a bigger group. Right. She's a bigger team, and probably she expects that within the party, she's as part of a team, she can do something.
But this party, why not Samopomots? Why not the Poroshenko bloc? Why not? There
are
other
parties. The smartest party who could play the game of putting her number one on their party list. No one else suggested
this, that. Right? Yeah, nobody else thought of that.
And then she says, now maybe all other parties have to put all the other Ukrainian political prisoners or the prisoners of war in Russia on their party list, because she is convinced that this very fact helped to pull her out of Russian prison. And well, it might be a naive belief, but this is we don't know which circumstances played a bigger role in her release. We still don't know what is behind it.
Yeah, no, there's an incredible backstory that's going to eventually come out there. Mark, did you want to finish your thought? I broke away from you when you were in mid.
Sure, no problem. I think, again, I mean, I think, look, precisely, the Tymoshenko party is the Tymoshenko party. You know, there is no real question about that. And yeah, I mean, so they got in first, and Savchenko, obviously, yeah, she needs to be operating within a party structure to be in parliament. She may well feel a degree of gratitude or loyalty at the moment. But again, I can't honestly see this lasting. I can't see there being room for two
exactly.
powerful figures.
Exactly. That party is not big enough for the two of them. Yeah. That's the first thing that crossed my mind when I was thinking, and I think several people have written about this, that there's bound, that marriage is not going to end well.
I mean, while we're playing sort of parallels, you know, if not Havel or Leonard Meri, I mean, I was thinking, okay, Savchenko in some ways it could be the Ukrainian Joan of Arc. Who, okay, admittedly didn't turn out too well for her, but nonetheless, perhaps a happier ending.
I'm not sure we want to go there. But
the whole thing about Joan of Arc was that she was about the cause, and in many ways, her actions were also deeply antithetical to the power structures within France at the time. And precisely because she was uncompromising and because she felt the need to do that. And I can't help but feel that actually, you know, the arch political operator Tymoshenko and this kind of, you know, Joan of Arc type figure make for what seems to me a very, very perverse and not very long-lasting relationship.
And there's some very practical things that are going to be like coming up soon, because Tymoshenko is pushing for early elections, which Poroshenko doesn't want. Where is Savchenko going to come down on that? And that's probably going to have some resonance with society, where she comes down, because she does in this honeymoon period. This scandal is going to come up. This conflict is going to come up. What do you think about that?
Well, I think she will have a very difficult relationship with Tymoshenko, because Tymoshenko is trying to use her instrumentally, and she's not the kind of person to be used. She doesn't see herself in that role, and I think she is also very very kind of person who really has a lot of friends in the lower strata of the society, and I think she's more influenced by that kind of people than by the politicians, at least at the moment. And if she feels that this is the way that the people don't want to go, she won't go.
Mm. Do you see her maybe gravitating towards the people that emerged out of the Maidan and who are now in the Rada?
She's part of that. She's part of those people. Yeah.
But I mean, but they're spread among different parties, but they also sort of form almost an informal bloc in the parliament.
Yes, and they still have connections with the real world. I would say with the world of the civil society, and that's where their strengths come from. And they were not very powerful, not extremely powerful in the Ukrainian parliament. They could not break the system from the inside as they imagined that they would or they hoped for. But at the moment, they were still quite capable of blocking some of the important decisions, like creating a new constitution, which would include some provisions for Donbas, for the occupied territories and things like that. So they were able to do something, and of course, many of them expect the new elections and things like that if they see that they cannot absolutely work within the present system.
Right. One other thing I'd say we should be watching is, and it bears mentioning, that in all but one case in Ukraine's post-Soviet history, the incumbent president has lost the election, which leads me to believe that the next president's name may not be Petro Poroshenko. And this is also significant. Mark, any last thoughts before we move on to the next topic?
Yeah, I think that it wouldn't be surprising if actually we do begin to see kind of a realignment potentially of, rather than the old parties, which are much more linked to sort of oligarchic interests and regional interests and so forth, but precisely sort of a much more of a sense of the younger outsiders who may well actually come from a variety of different political perspectives, but who share a belief that it's necessary to shake things up. It could well be that actually, you know, Savchenko's arrival helps galvanize that. I'm still wondering, okay, well, what happens if, or maybe even when, something happens, let's say that, for example, the political class reaches a consensus on a deal on the Donbass that for Savchenko is actually failing to meet Ukraine's national interests, or perhaps is implicitly allowing Crimea to go its own way, or some other really big crunch issue. And I think that'll be interesting, because everything we've seen suggests that she's the sort of person who won't be just simply looking to be bought off, won't be simply be willing to just simply accept the consensus for an easy life, or because of the sense of, well, that's what we need to do, but will be willing to actually go nuclear. That, I think, is going to be really interesting, because what we've seen is a dynamic within the Rada, as within Ukrainian politics as a whole, which is basically a kind of creeping Borg-like assimilation. That people come in with all kind of high hopes and personal individualism, and then just get sucked into and incorporated within these structures of patronage and, frankly, corruption and complicity. Well, at the moment, you know, again, we have very little to go on, really. But as near as we can currently tell about Savchenko, it seems highly unlikely that she will be willing to go that way. And therefore, she's this unusual character of someone who's not likely to be assimilated, and yet who certainly at the moment still has the profile to actually matter.
Mm. No, this is certainly going to be very.
This was actually one of her first phrases on TV when she landed, when her the president's airplane landed in Ukraine. She said, "Leave me alone for a second. I need to gather my thoughts and not to get corrupted." Well, she used a stronger word, but this is what she really meant, that I really need to gather myself and to realize where this danger of corruption comes from and to fight it.
Yeah, no, that was a really remarkable scene, and this is going to be fascinating to watch going forward, this new element that's been introduced into Ukraine's raucous politics. Well, in a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and broaden the aperture to look at Russia's tendency for hostage-taking and the goals of this practice. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from London is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And with me here in the studio in Prague is Natalia Chudikova, managing editor of RFRL's Ukrainian service and host of the program European Connect. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Сьогодні виніс обвинительний приговор українському режисеру Олегу Сенцову.
Українця осудили за шпіонаж в Росії і приговорили к 6 годам.
Гражданину України Валентину Выгорскому.
В тюрмах России томится 11
тюрем. Томятся ещё более 10 украинцев.
Месяцем сотрудники ФСБ задержали майдановца прямо на выходе из...
Надя Савченко may have been Russia's most famous hostage, but she certainly wasn't the only one. Dozens of Ukrainians remain in Russian prisons on charges that are flimsy at best. Many of them from the annexed Crimean Peninsula, whose only crime was speaking out against the Russian occupation. The most prominent among these is the award-winning film director Oleg Sentsov. And it isn't just Ukrainians. In September 2014, Russia seized the Estonian law enforcement officer Eston Kokver from Estonian territory and later exchanged him for a Russian spy. Mark, there seems to be like spy swaps in a lot of these cases. Is there a larger purpose to this practice on the Russian on the part of the Russians? Is it it's known for taking pride in getting its spies back, right? Kokver was exchanged for a spy. Savchenko was exchanged for two GRU officers, and you have to wonder if there's a trend here, or am I barking up the wrong tree?
I think I personally think there's several different processes that we actually have to unpick. There are people, I mean, Eston Kokver, I don't think he was actually snatched for the swap. I think he was snatched because of particularly the operation he was looking into, which is almost certainly a sort of a intelligence come organized crime ring that was operating across the border.
Cigarette smuggling, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, exactly. But I think in my view, it was sort of the FSB's involvement was to raise money that then they could spend on corrupting political parties in the West and that kind of thing.
And they snatched him to stop the operation, basically.
Yeah, because this is exactly
to stop, what to stop his investigation into the operation. Right.
Precisely. I think he was just getting a little bit too close and a little bit too shrewd. But of course, once they grabbed him, of course, they were then going to also use him to their fullest advantage. But on the other hand, I think if they grabbed him purely from the purpose of a swap, I think probably the deal would have been struck rather more quickly. Mm. So I think this is a classic example of Russian parsimony. You know, if you've got someone anyway, then you might as well see if their release can actually be used for some political advantage. But in other cases, I mean, if we look, for example, at the people from Crimea, I don't think for a minute we should be thinking of them as hostages. I think we should be thinking of them as political prisoners. But again, from the Russian point of view, just as with the Soviets, political prisoners can often also be useful commodities. So rather than, I think, thinking that actually, oh, well, they're going out there and hunting for hostages because they know that they want to make a deal or whatever, they actually arrest and detain a whole bunch of people whom they just don't like. They don't like their activities. They don't like who they are. They don't like who they're saying. And in some cases, they will just lock them up for as long as they can. And in some cases, they will then try and make trades with them, especially, and I think this is something that is sort of becoming an increasing factor, especially because these people then become cause célèbre. And anyway, I mean, going back to the business as to whether or not actually putting her on the party list helped Savchenko get out, I don't know. But that was just part and parcel of a whole campaign. You know, she did become this iconic figure of Ukrainian national resistance, and you had other Western countries raising her case and so forth. So The thing with Savchenko is that actually holding her had become a cost. And therefore what they wanted to do was at once get rid of the cost, but also get a positive deal struck. Mm. And yeah, absolutely, there is a strong Russian tradition that we get our people back. So these two Spetsnaz officers have now been quietly sort of brought back. Obviously, not much of a fanfare, because who wants to admit that your Spetsnaz get caught? I think this is the thing. It's actually just simply a process of the Russians are quite happy to snatch and grab and detain people and then, in a way, treat them all as commodities.
Yeah, no, this practice has certainly escalated since Russia's aggression against Ukraine began, let's call it by its proper name. Just this week, in fact, just yesterday, Mykola Karpyuk and Stanislav Klich, two Ukrainians, were convicted. And the more I looked into this case, this thing makes your head spin. Mm-hmm. These guys were convicted of participating in the Chechen War on the side of the Chechen separatists and killing 31 Russian soldiers. They were sentenced yesterday to 22 years and 22 years and a half, yeah, respectively, yeah. If not mistaken. They were incommunicado for more than a year after being captured.
Yeah, well,
allegedly tortured.
Exactly. Yeah.
And one of them implicated Seni Yatsenyuk and also participating in the Chechen War under torture. I mean, this case is just outrageous. They were sentenced just a day after Savchenko was freed. There's the case of Solshenko, yeah, this is a 73-year-old pensioner who has cancer, who was arrested on spying charges. Mm-hmm. I mean, the list goes on and on. Like I said, there's about 30 of them, to my knowledge. But Natalia, what do you think? Are these cases now going to really start to resonate in Ukraine now that Savchenko's free and has taken up this cause, or have they always been resonating and just Savchenko's been getting most of the attention?
She was sort of on the pinnacle of this whole pyramid of political prisoners and prisoners of war and people who were like Crimean Tatars. The only reason to take them is to take them hostages, and it's a pure intimidation exercise against the whole population of Crimean Tatars in Crimea, because for Russia it's something that is completely anti-systemic, which happens in Crimea among the Crimean Tatars, that there is a national organization, which is a civic society organization, which is a national parliament, and the Russians don't know what to do with it. It's something completely incorruptible, unbreakable, so they had
It's civil society. They don't know how to deal with it because they don't understand it.
Yeah, and there is a long tradition of this organization, which is several decades old, and it survived the Soviet regime, and it came out as a winner in this fight with the Soviet regime. They were able to come back to Ukraine and to resettle there. So it's if you look at it from the Ukrainian point of view, there are several different kinds of prisoners, and it seems like the Russians are going to treat them also very differently. And the thing that many commentators in Ukraine pointed out is that we now have to focus even more on these people after the first victory that Savchenko was released. And if Putin is going to release even more of them, what's going to happen to the others? Are they going to be treated as prisoners of war, like under the Minsk agreement, for example? Some of them could be. The Crimean Tatars and the whole bunch of people who were taken from Crimea could not be seen as prisoners of war because they are not part of the Minsk agreement. Right. So there is a whole range of questions, the whole range of problems. And on top of all of that, the war is still on.
Right.
We can release prisoners. We can do whatever it takes to make them free, but new prisoners can appear.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, some of these were taken in occupied Crimea. Some of them were taken in Donbass, but some of them were Ukrainian citizens who went to Russia for one reason or the other and got grabbed in Russia.
Right.
Which leads me to believe maybe Ukrainians should think twice about going to Russia. Because when you look at these lists of these people, I mean, a 73-year-old pensioner, for God's sake, this could happen to anybody.
Well, this already happened to a guy who was on his business trip, or he was doing some small business, and he was grabbed there, and they checked that he was on Maidan, and they completely created a new case on him. So his name is Yatsenko, and somehow he was kidnapped. I mean, he was arrested there, and then it was very strange how he was released. So it's a bit of absurd theater of absurdity. You can't really, there is no pattern which you can say this is how things are being done. They catch people absolutely without any pattern, without any system, and then they create whatever absurd cases,
right.
And the level of absurdity is infinite.
Yeah, and when he was asked at his year-end press conference whether there will be exchanges for these Ukrainian prisoners, Putin said, well, any exchange has to be of equal value, spoken like a true kidnapper, mm-hmm. You know, in a lot of ways. Mark, is this just a campaign of intimidation, or would...
Well, again, I think we come back to the fact that I think that, you know, it tends to be multiple things. I mean, absolutely, I agree with the fact that it's a campaign of intimidation that we're seeing in Crimea. But let's just take those two Ukrainians convicted of being involved in the Chechen war. I mean, apart from the fact that one has to wonder what it says if two Ukrainians can kill 31 Russians, they're actually saying something deeply alarming about the Russian armed
forces.
And
those Russians weren't even in the place the Ukrainians were alleged to have been, so they must
that
be
is fiendish,
Ukrainians with superpowers, I guess.
Well, I mean, don't really understand if we can seriously discuss this issue, because we all understand that this is an absurd.
Right. No, it is. And I think Mark was pointing that out.
The point is, I mean, let's be honest. If we haven't even got on to Yatsenyuk as the Ukrainian Rambo, we know we have wandered into realms of absurdity and surrealism. But the whole point is, why do they say it? I mean, they don't just throw dice and consult a table and decide which charge they're going to put in. I mean, if one takes this, again, it fits into a long-term continuity of wanting to use the Chechen War, which, after all, was a purely imperial Russian conflict, but claiming that it demonstrates how certain outside powers have it in for Russia. I mean, remember the mythology of the White Stockings.
The White Stockings, yeah, the Bielé Kolgotki.
Snipers.
Estonian snipers, yeah.
Exactly. Well, of course, never trust the Estonians, after all. But, you know, actually... The reason why they're bringing it up now, well, I mean, in part, I think it might be because actually it's very clear that there's distinctly little resonance in Russia on the whole for the Donbass conflict. Insofar as there were passions at the beginning when Pierre Canal was talking about, you know, people being crucified, you know, kids being crucified by fascists and everything else, that definitely hasn't lasted. And I said, I think it was only skin deep then. There is no evidence at the moment, really, that Russians feel that strongly about what's going on in the Donbass. And therefore, I think, again, there is always going to be this need to try and whip things up and just simply say, well, it's not just about that. It's, you know, actually that we may not have realized it, but we've been fighting, or the Ukrainians have been fighting a war against us for years. You see, they were even actually trying to kill our boys in Chechnya. Again, I mean, you know, it's not as if this is part of some grand plan that is worked out in the Kremlin. It's like so many other things. People know what the overall line is, and therefore you're going to get, whether it's investigators here or you know, secret policemen there, fitting in that. They got these guys, and what charge are they going to levy against them? Well, at the moment, they obviously decided that a convenient one was that they were sort of diversionaries in Chechnya. In other cases, you have the guy, well, let's say he's a spy, a most unusual 73-year-old cancer-ridden spy, but that's precisely it. That's why it's so subtle. I mean, it's all nonsense, of course, but the point is, it fits into this notion of trying to have multiple functions. You arrest people to intimidate wider communities, you create narratives around them that hopefully play to your base and inspire and inflame them, And then in due course, if they have any value, quote unquote, obviously they're all human beings, they all have equal value. But, you know, if in geopolitical terms they have value, then you see what kind of a deal you can do with them. It's a three-stage process in that respect.
So at the end of the day, you have 30 Ukrainian citizens, roughly 30 Ukrainian citizens, who, as far as I can see, committed no crime. And at the end of the day, they're going to be exchanged for Russians who have committed crimes at the end of the day. I mean, this is what it all, at the end of the day, if you really look at it in a cold kind of material sense, Russia wins. They got two GRU officers that were illegally fomenting armed rebellion in the Donbass Bakh for Savchenko, who was legally defending her country against outside aggression.
I don't think Ukrainians see it in this way. They see it. They also followed the landing of the Russian,
which was remarkable,
of the Russian aircraft with these two people and who met them and under what circumstances and what the Russian TV said on that. There was practically nothing said or seen from that meeting, and the conclusion that the wider public makes out of it is that we are fighting for our people. Our people have value. They matter for us. And for Russians, they don't matter. And that's why I think it was for the Ukrainian politicians, it was easy to exchange those two people, those two Russian officers, for Nadiya Savchenko, because she was really important. And I think there would even a bigger exchange in terms of people wouldn't make a problem for the Ukrainian politicians to make. It's another question that no one really buys the story of the importance of two Russian officers for the Russian Federation in this exchange story. So there is a suspicion that there is something much bigger, concessions that the Ukrainian side had to make to free Savchenko.
Yeah. No, and another thing that the contrasting images showed us was that, I mean, Ukraine can treat Savchenko as a hero because she was openly doing something Ukraine says it's doing, defending itself against the Russian aggression. Russia doesn't even admit it's involved in a conflict in Ukraine, and therefore it could not treat these two as heroes, because it would have been tacitly admitting that it was active in the Donbass. Natalia, you touched on something and it's perfect timing because we're coming up to the end. So this is what I wanted to finish with.
I just wanted to say one joke, and I just can't stop. The joke on the Ukrainian social networks was that it's just unclear why the two militiamen who they said that they were from Luhansk, why they were sent to Russia instead.
But no sooner was Savchenko released than the rumors started to fly. The speculation started to fly that there was some secret deal on sanctions. I mean, the release happened just days after Putin, Poroshenko, Angela Merkel, and Francois Hollande held a conference call, and just weeks before the European Union is meeting to decide on sanctions. Now, in the intervening days between then and now, all the noises coming out of Brussels have been that sanctions are going to be renewed. That the signals seem to be, but there is the suspicion is out there. Is it how widespread is it in Ukraine?
It's very widespread because for this particular reason, that the Russians were not interested in their people, so there must be something much more important for them.
Mm-hmm. Mark, what do you think? Is there more to this swap than meets the eye?
The honest answer is I have absolutely no idea. But I think when it comes down to it, look.
But we're here to speculate.
If we're talking about Russia winning, I mean, it might have seemed to have won transactionally with this swap of sort of taking, you know, the whether two pawns make a knight or whatever. But politically, yes, they actually released Savchenko. But no one, I think, actually regards this as any sort of great step forward. Everyone knows that Moscow did it because it felt it had to, rather than because it was now suddenly suffused with peace and light. So if there's going to be a sanctions deal, this cannot be it. This in itself, I don't think it has anything like the kind of weight. If it's the first stage in some kind of attempt for Moscow to say, okay, we're turning a renewed leaf and we're now going to disengage slightly from Donetsk or whatever, That's another matter. But in and of itself, this cannot be the basis for anything more substantive.
Well, yeah, and what I thought of when I was thinking along those lines, I had to recall that the intervention in Ukraine was preceded by the release of Khodorkovsky and the pardoning of the women of Pussy Riot, and then there was speculation back then that Moscow was turning over a new leaf, and they certainly were doing nothing of the sort. Any last thoughts from anybody before we call it a week and break for the weekend? All right, on that note, we'll wrap it up. That's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from London has been co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert on Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And with me here in the studio in Prague has been Natalia Chudikova, managing editor of RFRL's Ukrainian service and host of the program European Connect. Thank you both for an enlightening, fascinating, and lively discussion.
Thank you, Brian. Pleasure.
I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my totally awesome and indispensable colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFRL's Russian-language television program, Current Time, which you can watch at www.currenttime.tv, and you can also follow Pavel's really cool Twitter feed at Pasha Butorin. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week, and now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.